Hi, my name is Kunal, and welcome to the Geeks of the Valley podcast, which connects with some of the brightest minds globally who are leading their respective industries today to discuss the hottest upcoming industry trends and how their work is affecting the global economy. What started off as a coffee chat has now grown into a global platform for visionaries. This morning, from the San Francisco Bay Area, we have the current chief measurement strategist at Google joining us and author of the book, Converted, The Data-Driven Way to Win Customers' Hearts, which was just published as of February 2022. Please welcome Neil Hoyne. Neil, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
And Neil, how are things with you in light of the COVID situation?
I mean, they are what they are. I think it's difficult in all parts of the world. A little bit more challenging because I have, as you know, two toddlers who means they're not only unvaccinated, but they're also at that stage where they will try to put everything they possibly can in their mouths, which makes the premise of air travel a little bit more daunting. We're going to test that out later in the summer. But otherwise, just everybody slowly starting to return to office here in the Valley has been a wonderful thing.
I'm happy to hear that. And let's jump into the first question, shall we?
Please.
So Neil, tell me about yourself and your background and how it led you to the path of joining Google as a chief measurement strategist.
You know, I look at myself as being part data analytics geek, part storyteller, which is to say that on the data and analytics side, I wouldn't put myself in the same category as a statistician or a mathematician by any means, even arguably not even a computer scientist, but just one that has enough understanding about the data to be curious and to start to apply it, which actually works to my benefit because when I'm going through problems, it's not necessarily that I'm inclined to build a perfect model or perfect solution as much as I am a hobbyist to see how different types of technology can be applied to solve different problems. And then on the storytelling side, it's really about the collaboration. A lot of my work is not necessarily with other researchers or data scientists as much as it is people within organizations, people internally at Google who are trying to figure out how they can use data in a different way. And I kind of joke around with people that it's an area of huge opportunity simply because there's so much data being collected by organizations and so little that they're actually using. And so we talk about this in the book that only about 6 out of every 100 decisions being made in an organization are being made through data. And so that means that 94 out of the 100 decisions being made in organizations, being made by, to the listeners, to your organizations, are being made primarily on intuition and gut feeling. And that doesn't change based on the experience level of the marketer. It's just that for a majority of companies, they find even though they're collecting data, they don't necessarily have the tools or the understanding to know how that data should change or shape their decision-making. And so that's always just been a question that I've been curious about, is to see in these eras of big data and all the promise and potential, how is it actually realized? And so that was something that I just kind of forced myself into early on in my career through, let's say, luck or just interest. And then I've really spent at least the past 11 years at Google trying to develop that, working with companies externally, some of our largest advertisers, to figure out why is it that they are taking different pieces of data and arguably trying to attract the same types of customers, but making wildly different decisions based on what should be pretty straightforward. The data is what it is, and having different results because of it. And so that's really just what my career is about. It's been about, well, how do we take this data and make it useful, but then also how do we explain it to other functions so that they can start to get over that gap of only the 6 or 7 decisions they're making today? How do we help them make some incremental progress towards how they understand and apply that data to their decision-making?
So Neil, what is the book all about? What story are we trying to tell?
At its core, it's a story about how companies find growth. When I started talking to so many companies, invariably companies started asking back and they said, hey, what are you seeing? How are companies being successful? We know it's not just implementing a new CRM system. We know it's not adopting cloud. We know it's not a broader subject area around machine learning. What can you tell us at the C-suite that makes companies successful with that data? That was the first question. And when you think about that background that I have, that's satisfying the first half of what I do, which is using the data to understand where there's an opportunity for growth, how companies can apply it. The second element is a storytelling component of it, which is simply to say, and I joke about this quite frequently, that even as a data and analytics person by trade, I don't read data and analytics books. I mean, they're god awful. I mean, they're boring. And it's not the intention or the fault of the author. It's just if it's 8 or 9 o'clock at night and you're thinking, all right, I have Netflix over here, I have my kids over there. Something fun. I managed to find one of the new Xboxes or PlayStation 5s. And then you look in the corner and you're like, but here's a book on SQL, or here's a book on data and analytics. We know how difficult that case is to make. And so when you look at the broader market and you're going to anybody saying, do you want to read a book about data? It's hard to find an enthusiastic audience. I mean, maybe my mom, because she would read anything. She's not in data science, so I don't think she's a core audience. She would read it because I wrote it. But I took that challenge early on to say, not only can the book be about growth and about data, but the book has to be written in a way where it is approachable and it is accessible by audiences that normally would want to have no interest in a data book. And so it really stressed both sides. One was to be able to define what are the growth strategies driving companies for the next 3 to 5 years, but also in a way that is accessible and interesting, and I would argue even conversational, to a non-technical audience. And so that was really the challenge. And to be honest, when I wrote this book initially, the goal was just to self-publish it, to put it out there so people would have access to this type of material. And that was really the goal I set for the project. I said, I just want to write something that's, you know, 30, 40,000 words. I want to put it out there so other people can benefit from these very unique insights. And it just so happened that it ended up in front of a publisher, Penguin Random House. I think they're the largest publisher, second largest publisher in the world. And it was about 72 hours. They saw the book on Friday. They saw the first couple chapters. And they ended up buying the rights on the following Monday, which was kind of almost validation for me that I was able to hit that box. Was to say, not only just more data in a book that's unique, but also something that they think that there's a market for and people want to read. And so far, that's what we've been seeing. The response to the book is people saying exactly that, which is to say, not only am I learning a lot, but that was actually pretty fun to read. Like, I see what a good story can do for really interesting data.
So coming back on one of your points, when you say you wanted to ensure that you weren't just tailoring this book to a technical audience, but rather to the common person, what processes did you follow to ensure that you hit the nail on the head?
You know, being out in the valley for a while, there's always this temptation of, you know, like kind of these founders that write these stories and be like, well, how did you build this business model? And they're like, and I looked over the horizon and I saw this great opportunity nobody saw. And I pointed and said, we're going that way. And then you talk to everybody and you're like, no, you didn't. Like it was trial and error. And it was very much the same thing with this book, which was to say, you know, the first several months, we're just obsessing about the right model and the right approach. And you know it once you get there, because when you get there, it's something that somebody reads. And this is why I generally encourage people. I say, look, don't agree to read the entire book. Just read the first chapter, read the first two chapters. And if you want to give up, that's fine. And I even put those chapters for free on the website just to make the point. But it was just one of those things that you had to focus on. And I think what ended up making that happen was not that I had a deliberate strategy about how to happen, but that I knew that I needed it in the end result. I needed something that I could hand over to people. I could say, here's the first chapter, the first two chapters. And I wanted them, and this was kind of the informal saying, was, would you come back and do you want to read more? Or are you kind of like, hey, that was kind of interesting. All right, we'll see how that goes. And that was really the standard. And then it was just a matter of deliberation to say, I don't exactly know how it's going to turn out, but we are going to refine and we're going to iterate just like any other product, any other strategy, until you get to that right voice, that right message. And what I always keep in mind for this, and this is kind of what I coach, you know, people on earlier in their careers, is that I say, oftentimes books feel very much like the boardroom conversation that you have at work, where a whole bunch of people sit down. It's very formal. It's very structured. It's very predictable. Somebody stands up and presents slides. Here's the executive summary. Here's the agenda for the day. And it just follows that, and you pretend to listen, but you're probably paying attention to something else, wondering when you get out. And then afterwards, everybody goes to a bar or goes to a restaurant afterwards, and they're sitting around at a table. And those conversations are much more engaging. They're much more honest. They're much more real. And if somebody asks you at that point, hey, what do you think is a good strategy for data? The decorum wouldn't say, oh, well, you stop the conversation, you reach into your backpack, and you bring out those slides. No, you never would. You would tell the stories that are interesting. You'd provide an honest, candid perspective. You just want to be, you want to be you. And that was kind of the story that I always had in the back of my mind, was to say, if you read this, does it sound like a conversation like me? The conversation you and I are having, where we're just sharing our honest thoughts, or does it sound like something that was overly scripted and polished, not to offend anybody, not to challenge the status quo, but just to kind of regurgitate information? That was definitely what I wanted to avoid.
Now, Neil, taking a step back, when looking at today's economies of scale, relying on data has, in a way, become a crucial base for businesses to build these long-term relationships with customers, and in turn ensure that consistent revenue distribution for the business. In your expert opinion, would it be data, personal skills, or both, which play a role into what one would say as closing a transaction?
You know, I would say that personal skills are playing a stronger role in it. Not necessarily because I think that personal skills, and we go back into the intuition and the heart, because they outweigh the importance of data, but I just see that there is a large disconnect between the people that are analyzing the data and the people that are applying it in the field. And the way that I kind of look at it, and this is an interesting model a business person once told me about, was it ties back to that film, what is it, probably the 50s, the 60s, The Wizard of Oz. And he kind of made the mention, he said, look, in business, you really need three things. And The Wizard of Oz captures that perfectly. He's like, you need a brain, which is your data. You need a heart, which allows you to see and understand the customer and other people in the organization. And you need the courage to do something with those insights and with that conviction. And part of the challenge that we're confronted with in this space is finding a balance for all of them. Because it's easy to say, look, the data should always win. But the assumption then is that the data can explain everything. And I think human beings are far too nuanced for a spreadsheet to capture that in the entirety. On the other hand, if you lead too much with the heart, you know, you will have this, maybe the sense of optimism or the sense of dread or a sense of creativity that doesn't necessarily hold itself to being accountable, to testing, and to learning. And so those two in particular have to balance out. And kind of how you phrase that question, you know, is it the data side or is it the people side, I think plays into that particular type of model. And then that third part is that it doesn't matter what ideas you have, it doesn't matter what data you have. If you don't have the courage, if you don't have the conviction to make a change in your business, if you're going to sit there and search for that perfect answer, you're not going to find it. And so I always keep that in mind, because I say that these all come together. And I think companies that lean far too much on the head or the heart, or just lack courage altogether, are not going to make any progress. And it's just worthwhile. And I say, these are not, it's not that data always wins or that you can build a perfectly data-driven organization. I think the most successful organizations are ones that simply find a balance across all three.
So going off this point a bit, when looking at the brain, the heart, and having the courage, can you give some examples of companies you see today which kind of represent all three aspects, or maybe one of the three aspects, or two of the three?
I would say I have to be mindful here just not to directly call out any companies, because I know that's always a sensitive area to say. You're too driven by intuition and not by heart. I'll tell you the way that I generally look at companies, and this is kind of how I test them when I talk to companies about it, is I like to ask just a simple standard group of questions, which I'll use both with the CEOs, but also with, you know, people in lower tiers of the organization, like analysts. And what I love to ask them about is I love to ask them simply, how do they see decisions getting made in their company? And the CEOs, by the way, always have the most idealistic views. They're like, well, we look at the data and then we balance it by the market risk and the opportunity, and then we take action, right? Very decisive, very clear. And I always like to see, I'm like, what's the contrast between their point of view and what's actually happening for the people that are at the very front lines, working with the data, working with the customers, and often you start to see those differences. And so the more of a separation you see between the idealistic C-levels and the frontline workers, that leads me to a problematic company. And so when I talk to the CEOs, we can do any test, and you talk to the analysts and say, how hard is it to get your ideas surfaced? Do you believe your data is being used in the right way? Or is it distorted to sell a particular story? If you want to run a test, how difficult is it to get approvals? And if your test doesn't work, how strict are the penalties? Effectively, do the penalties discourage you from taking those risks where you're only testing relatively safe bets? And so the really question that I have is not only how difficult is it for them in their role, but how much does the organization recognize that this is a problem? And so sometimes you'll talk to these executives and you'll say, what is the decision-making process? And they will be honest and they say, you know, we're not really good at it, but we're getting better. I will trust and I will admire those executives more than I will for any executive that tells me it's perfect. Because the reality is it's never perfect. It's just, do they think it is? Because if they recognize that it's a problem and that their company's struggling to use the data that they have, I think that's a wonderful thing because they have an honest perspective about that what's happening in the world. That 6% number I gave earlier, that is across 350 marketers. That's not just one company. It is generally what's happening across every company. It's just, do the companies recognize it's a problem? If they do, they will start to take steps to solve it. If they don't, they'll let the status quo persist. And what you'll see is those really great people who want to affect some type of change, they will leave. And so it's generally where I started. I want to see what things look like on both sides of the organization. I want to see how those decisions are made, how that data is being used. And then I have a really deep bench of probably a couple thousand companies by this point where I can kind of calibrate to say, I think you're figuring it out, or I think I have a lot of confidence. I will wager that you will be successful versus you kind of have your head in the sand about what's actually happening within data in your organization. You believe you're data-driven, but you're really not. And that's making it difficult for you to start to attack and address the problems at hand.
So how would you define data-driven?
I look at data-driven as a relative scale. So I like to use the picture. It's a funny visual where a lot of people, you know, if you're a camper in the forest and a bear is chasing you, your goal is not necessarily to outrun the bear. That's impossible. Your goal is simply to be faster than other campers. And I look at that very much in the sense of being a data-driven company. I don't think it's possible to be a completely data-driven company, to make 100 out of 100 of your decisions based on data. I think a more pragmatic goal is to say, are you making on average more decisions using data than what your competitors are doing? And when companies tend to take that view, they stop looking internally at all the struggles and the processes they have and start to say, what are the difficult challenges that are affecting our entire industry that we know are affecting our competitors? Whether it's in the book, we talk about measuring lifetime value. With some companies, it's running experimentation. Other companies, it's simply proving that the investments they made are paying off. All these companies that you're competing with are having similar challenges. And so the question is, well, how do companies win? How do I see them as being productively data-driven? Is being able to make better decisions, quicker decisions than the companies in their market. You know, where I spend a lot of my time in online auctions don't reward perfect information because it doesn't exist. They reward having better information. Having better information about the value of that click, of that customer, of that transaction than other people in the auction. But far too many companies stand on the sidelines and say, look, we're not going to do anything until we have perfect data, which effectively means they don't act at all and the opportunity costs pile up. So when I really look at a data-driven company, I look at it to say, are you better than the other people you're competing with? Even if you're far from perfect, simply being better and being a more data-driven company is enough to find success. And I say that not because there's a certain amount of irreverence to the people that are trying to pursue that ideal, but just to let them know that they don't have to have everything right. No company I've worked with, not even at Google, has perfectly clean data. No company has it. And if you accept that, then it takes a little pressure off your shoulders to say, nobody has perfect data. What can we do to maximize the data and the opportunities we have at hand? And that's really the question you want to answer. Too many companies are like, well, over the next 3-5 years, we're going to integrate everything. No. What can you do today just to be a little bit better than you were yesterday, a little bit better than the people you're competing with.
So speaking of data and how companies utilize the data on hand, you find that with freemium business models, as well as many others, comes an opportunity cost for the individual or the user, where that person's data is being sold to larger corporations. Some would say this is unethical. Some would say that they are data-driven insights to further tailor products and services to a customer's needs. What are your thoughts on this?
I would say that both arguments are equally valid. My challenge to any company that will take that position, however, is if you were to fully disclose to your consumers how that data is being used and giving them the control to opt in or opt out, even at the cost of the service, to say, we won't offer this service. So they understand the value exchange that they're getting. Would your business model still be able to function? And that's kind of where I look at it. And thankfully, privacy laws are headed in that direction. I think that it's important that consumers are really given three things. One is they have transparency into what companies are capturing and what companies are doing with that data. They have control, the ability not only to opt out of the capture or selling of that data, but if they want to cancel that relationship and reclaim that data. And then I think the third part, which underlies the first two, is that they have trust in the organization that what is being shared, the transparency and the control, is in fact being honored. And I think those really should be table stakes for any organization that's looking into that game. And if consumers are willing to accept that deal, by all means, carry that out. But if they aren't, or if your current customers would be surprised or disgusted as to what's being captured and what's being understood or how their data is being applied, then I say, not only should you be a little bit more proactive in resolving that situation, but with the direction of privacy laws today, I don't see a lot of long-term potential for that business model. And so the pendulum went to one way where it was companies could capture anything and sell it a million times over, to now it's coming the other way. And we see this here in California, where the state's saying, no, consumers have these rights too. They may individually not be as large or as well-resourced as your company, but we're going to use the power of the state and also in some cases, technology providers injecting themselves into the conversation, saying, we're going to give them more of this control. And in order to play in this space, you need to provide them with the transparency and you need to also provide them with the ability to opt out. And so what I think is going to happen is that, you know, this type of question, I think 3 or 4 years ago, it would have been a matter of opinion where companies would have said, well, we'll see if we can do this, or maybe they wouldn't do this, or they could hide behind, you know, what's common, everybody's doing it. And I think now we're seeing more standardization around those rights, more awareness of consumers. They're making it easier for them to exercise those rights. And so I'd really say for anybody that's thinking about a business model in this context, to go out and to test it with consumers first, to say, if you do give consumers these choices, how often are they going to exercise them? And that will kind of give you that gut check to say, are they okay with what you're providing? Or are they starting to get that feeling in the pit of their stomach saying, this may not be a business that I want to share this information with or that I want to be part of?
It is going to be interesting for sure to see how tech policy is going to develop along with these technological advancements and how big tech is going to be held accountable for future data leaks.
You know, I think the interesting question that we're going to be faced with here on the data leaks is that, you know, right now you get a year of credit monitoring whenever your data leaks to a company. That's what they seem to offer you. So I have probably about 160 years worth of credit monitoring. So so my great-grandchildren, whoever decide to manage whatever estate I have when I die, their credit report's going to be monitored for years to come. And there's not a lot of value there. I see trust being destroyed with companies. And I think really what we're seeing here is the same thing that we're seeing in terms of the consumer controls. We're just seeing them in a different lens, which is states are starting to crack down on what type of notification has to be given, what type of compensation has to be given, even how long data can be stored to cut down on the number of these incidents happening. And so as more costs are piling up for companies, the business model is starting to change to say, in the past, maybe it was acceptable for you just to archive this data somewhere. And if it leaked, we lose a little bit of consumer trust. now the costs are so high that it really makes more economic sense to properly secure this data or delete this data or aggregate this data as early as possible so that it can't be leaked, or if it's gained access to, it won't be of much use to anyone. And so I think these are all positive developments. I always think about this through the lens of a consumer first. How would I feel with my data if I knew it was being used in a certain way? And I just feel that that context has been lost for a lot of companies and is finally starting to come back.
So Neil, we've spent this whole conversation talking about data, and you could say that very few people have access to the multiple sets of high quality data that you have been able to see over the course of your career. And as an individual, what one could say, you could basically predict where global industry trends will be in the next few years. Can you shed some light into this?
I can. I mean, I think that tech executives have a well-established history of making predictions that then become memes in 10 years. I think, you know, Bill Gates had one about like how much memory would be sufficient for everybody on computers. And so I'm mindful about making specific predictions, especially as we emerge from COVID. I have seen more position papers, more white papers. I remember one early on from a major consulting firm back in March of 2020 that was like, and by December, worst case scenario is everything's back to normal, but probably in July. And you're like, how do you come up with this? And so I'm mindful about making predictions about where I think global markets are going, where people are going to react. What I'm a little bit better at is looking at industries and saying, what industries are prime for disruption? And when I look at industries and you see enough dysfunction in organizations, and here's the general model that I have, is that my framework is expecting that in any company, when there are issues applying data, capturing data, integrating data. So those companies, it's like, we don't know what's happening online and offline. Those are the companies I'm talking about. And I see talented people inside that organization saying, look, we can't combine all this data. This is too much of a heavy lift inside our organization. Why don't we just leave and start our own company? And that's where I start to see those industries. When I start to see people inside organizations that start to get antsy to say, there's so much opportunity, but we can't get the executives to pay attention and we can't move this entire monster of a company. We should go do this on our own. Those are the industries that start to have my attention. Those are the industries that I start to say, ah, in this space, and sometimes it's not entire verticals, to say it's automotive or travel, sometimes it's smaller pockets. But when I start to see those people, then it gives me a sense to say something here will happen because I know these people can execute on, or ultimate way of looking at, I will invest in these people if they decide to disrupt the segment, because I think that the consumers, the market interest is there. And oddly enough, that type of story is not one that I just internalize. This is one that I share with executives, because sometimes you talk to them and you say, you know, we'd love to integrate this data and finally get online to offline working. They say, yeah, I'd love to do it, but I got a million other things. And I say, okay, how do you feel if 10 of your middle managers from your team decide to leave and build a competitor to your company, except they have their data integrated and they have a single view of the customer, or they're able to bid towards lifetime value when you're only looking at short-term KPIs? How does that make you feel? And it's generally in that point, you can see that the executives already agree with everything you're saying, except they know how hard it is to move across their organization. Everything that goes back to that earlier question we were discussing around running tests and applying data surfaces here, where they see opportunities for using data in a better way. And they know in some cases that they've made it so difficult for that organization to change that people internally who see the same problem, who genuinely care about solving it, will leave. And that's generally the approach I take, is when you start seeing that hit a critical mass inside an industry, then you know that's going to happen. Other industries are the exact opposite. Some of them, when you look at the almost the internet first companies, they don't see those same opportunities. So they need wholesale changes to business models. Those take a lot longer to see. In other cases, people are just saying, look, we know our company can't afford to invest in these types of customers because they don't have the data, but we could have the data. And so let's just go leave and do it ourselves. I love those types of companies. I love those types of markets. And those are generally the ones that I kind of lean towards. And a full disclaimer, none of them right now are crypto companies. I know it always comes up to like, so in crypto, we're gonna overhaul banking. I'm not sure it's that type of company. It's more in traditional industries.
Well, Neil, to wrap up our call with our last question here, do you plan on having a second book? And what piece of advice would you give to people out there from the journey you have had so far in life?
So will I write a second book? I have been told. So the short answer is no. I have been told, for those listeners who have been to Las Vegas, that writing a book is very similar to that experience for us, where you go to Las Vegas, you spend a couple of days there, and you just can't wait to go home. You're just like, I'm never doing this again. Like, you swear it off. And then for the next 3 or 5 years, you can't even think. You're just like, I could not do Vegas again. And then after that point, you're still like, huh, yeah, Vegas looks like it has some cool stuff. I haven't been there in a while. And all those negative memories fade away. And then you go back, and right away, that's what I've told will happen with the book. In about 3 years, I'll be like, God, writing a book was fun. I should do that again. And then you start doing it and you realize, oh, this is why I didn't want to write a book again. So give it a couple of years for the memories to fade, and then I'll jump right back into the whole writing and editing process. Advice to the readers, I'll stick on the book theme just for a moment. I think one of the hardest problems that I have, and this is with storytelling, this is for people that are on stage presenting, people that are presenting data, writing white papers, or trying to write a book. I think something, at least, and again, this reflects the U.S. educational system, but could be broadly applicable, is that everyone's taught about a certain way to write and to communicate. And I think these styles are designed to be very efficient and effective. So if you're writing a business letter, you want it to be clear, concise. Here's your bullet points. Here's your case. Here's your story. And what I would just challenge them to think is that there's certain mediums where you need to not only consider the message you're trying to convey, but the style in which it's conveyed. And so we oftentimes think that when people are reading a book, that they're sitting there and they're committed to the next 4 or 5 hours reading that book. And I think that's a mistake. It's a mistake, just like when you're on stage at a large show, thinking that everyone in the audience really wants to be there right now. My guess is people can probably find better things to do. They just somehow ended up there. Maybe their boss told them, or it's better than sitting in the office. If you have more care and concern for your audience, if your assumption going in is that you need to not only present the case, but also to make it intuitive, to appeal to their heart, to entertain them, you end up with a much different product. And so whenever you're thinking about communicating, whenever you're thinking about that second half of my role, which is not just simply finding and understanding data, but telling the right stories, have a great deal of sympathy for your audience and the way you're trying to convey these ideas. Go from the perspective that, you know, as compelling as your insights may be, you have to get them to care first. You have to get them to lean in, to really internalize that message, and think about how you would tell that story. Think about how that story would be different if you were at a restaurant or a bar versus a boardroom. Think about it if you took away the slides. Think about if there wasn't a recording, if there weren't hundreds of people, if there was just one person that you needed to give an honest perspective about the world. How would you do it? And so that's kind of my challenge to everyone out there. That's how you really use data. It's not cloud or the tools or learning more SQL. It's really making sure that what you already know, what you already see, can be conveyed to people in a way that's meaningful to them.
Neil, for anyone interested in catching a cup of coffee with you or reaching out to you, what would be the best point of contact?
The best point of contact, I was going to say, it's turning out to be LinkedIn. More and more people on Twitter, but LinkedIn is just something that's always up that I always try to answer to. If not, if you're also interested in continuing this conversation, what we're having, it is part of the reason why I recorded the entire audiobook. So if you're interested in a 4-hour version of this conversation, we had kind of the abridged version. The audiobook for Converted is also a way to do it as well.
Neil, it was a pleasure having you on Geeks of the Valley, and thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks again for having me.
This podcast is brought to you by PyTone, an Asian-based open-source enterprise software company. PyTone offers a suite of software applications and infrastructure services to scholars and universities.